This is edition number 1997 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 12th of December 2025. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 11th of December 2025. My name is Judith Elliott-Hunter and my fellow readers are...
Mary Wilson,
Sue Hill
and Jill Mellows.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 8 o'clock and will set about 20 minutes to 4.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes The Poor Man's Friend, Thomas Paine, Ben Young's Norfolk Roots and Career, Memories of Norfolk Snow, One of Our Favourite Birds and Its Decline.
But we begin with the main news items, which include Broadland Village Signs, Norfolk Artist, Villagers Left in Shock, Christmas Tractor Run, Bus Shelter Protest. Let's start with those lead stories.
The tiny Broadland community of Brunstead, near Stalham, uniquely now has two village signs. The original sign, stolen in 2018, was returned to the farmer Alan Beck by Andy Whitmill, a North Lincolnshire specialist tool restorer, at the weekend celebration. It was found thanks to Mr. Whitmill, who had brought the Brunstead sign for £80 at a Runway Monday sale on the Nottingham and Newark showground in September last year. With help from Humberside Police and Norfolk Constabulary, Mr. Whitmill tracked down the original owner, Mr. Beck, who had made the original sign with near neighbour Patrick Ames in 1991, erected it on the private drive to the family's farm and St. Peter's Church. It was a distinctive feature on the Stalham to Walcott Road before it was stolen in July 2018. On that same evening, another sign was taken from Brian and Janet Philby Grove's farm, Felbrig, near Cromer. It featured the farm's pedigree Simmental cattle in metalwork and was never been recovered. Mr. Beck of Orchard Farm then remade a copy of the sign, which was named after the former village pub, the Brumstead Drag Rake. The metal design was cut out thanks to Philip Crane of Hugh Crane and Sons of Upton and Neil Sands of Sands Agricultural Machinery, now of Catfield. This replacement sign featured a farm worker smoking a pipe, was unveiled in July 2019. Mr. Beck was delighted to have the original sign back. "I'm so grateful to Mr. Whitmill for bringing the sign back. We thought we'd lost it forever, but now we have two special signs putting Brumstead on the map, twice." Mr. Whitmill runs The Workshop, a business specialising in repairing vintage hand tools. Mr. Beck's farm have farmed at Hall Farm next to the medieval church since 1919. Almost half the 65-strong population of Brunstead watched the return of the village sign.
A beloved artist, best known for his inspiring television series and instructional books introducing generations to the joy of painting, has died, aged 91. Through his engaging teaching style and passion for art, Olwen Crawshaw became a familiar and trusted figure to millions of aspiring artists across Britain and beyond. Over a long and prolific career, he created and presented numerous art programmes for the BBC and Channel 4, including A Brush with Art, The Painting Challenge, and Crawshaw Paints. His approachable, down-to-earth manner and clear demonstrations made painting accessible to everyone, earning him a devoted following. His fame was further enhanced by the parody of Olwen and wife June in the BBC comedy sketch show The Farce Show. He was portrayed as Johnny Nice Painter, an ageing artist who goes on painting expeditions to the countryside with long-suffering wife Katie. All would go smoothly with sedate conversation about the views they are painting until something reminds the nice painter of the colour black and he becomes a changed man. Alwyn was also a celebrated author, publishing more than 20 books on painting techniques and art instruction, many of which became enduring favourites among amateur and professional artists alike. Born in Yorkshire, Alwyn trained at Hastings School of Art. He was a founder and former president of the Society of Amateur Artists, dedicated to encouraging creativity and sharing the pleasure of painting. His loved ones said, "He became a familiar and trusted figure to millions through his television series, books and teaching, sharing his love of painting with warmth, humour and immense generosity of spirit." Many amateur and professional artists owe their careers to Alwyn's infectious enthusiasm and encouragement. Alwyn Crawshaw died peacefully at his home on the Norfolk coast on Monday, November the 10th, following an illness. He leaves behind wife June, daughters Natalie and Donna, and son Clinton, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and many friends, admirers, and students who were touched and inspired by his creativity and kindness. Further details regarding funeral or memorial arrangements will be announced in due course. An unusual diamond wedding anniversary, the secret of a long marriage, must be a shared love of painting, as proven in 2017, when Alwyn and June Crawshaw celebrated 60 years together by holding a major art exhibition. The Munsley couple painted together for most of their married life and regularly went out to sketch together in the North Norfolk countryside. During their 60 years of marriage, they made a total of 8 television series on how to paint for the BBC and Channel 4. They also produced 28 books about painting and illustrating for HarperCollins Publishing and held major exhibitions all over the world, including Harrods, London and Tokyo. In August 2017, more than 100 of their artworks went on show at the Picturecraft Gallery in Holt as a celebration of their diamond wedding anniversary.
A man has appeared in court after he was arrested and charged with the murder of his neighbour in a Norfolk village. Christopher Brooks, 40, of Coastline Village near Ostend Road, Walcott, appeared at Norwich Magistrates Court on Tuesday. He has been accused of the murder of Robert Button, 73, along with criminal damage to property. Mr. Button was found with serious burns following a fire thought to have started in the doorway of his home on Sunday. He was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, but died as a result of his injuries. And Brooks, who had been arrested at the scene of the incident, was charged with murder. Brooks spoke only to confirm his name, address and date of birth at court and was not asked to enter pleas to the 2 charges. The case was due to be heard at Norwich Crown Court at 10 a.m. yesterday, with Brooks remaining in custody. A Home Office post-mortem examination was due to take place on Tuesday to determine Mr. Button's cause of death. On Tuesday, police were carrying out door-to-door inquiries in the area. Emergency services were called to the properties off Ostend Road after 3 separate reports of a dispute, and they found Mr. Button with serious burns from a fire. He was said to have gone to another neighbour's property for help and was later taken to the hospital for treatment, but died in the early hours of Monday. Police believe the fire was started deliberately in the doorway of the victim's property. Neighbours said Mr. Button have sold potatoes in a lay-by by outside Hoveton. Forensics were investigating the scene on Monday, including the victim's car, which had been covered in what appears to be paint and was parked very close next to the suspect's car. However, it remains unclear as to what was at the centre of the dispute that led to the tragic incident. One neighbour, who did not wish to be named, said, He was Bob, the potato man. Bless him. He was a good bloke. Another neighbour said, "It's absolutely a shock. I can't believe it. He always put his window down and said good morning." One villager said, "She was just in shock and tried to keep her children away from the windows when she realised what has happened. It's tragic. No one deserves that," she added. Peter Downing, who lives nearby, said he had heard a lot of shouting but did not realise how bad it was. "Then I saw flashing lights from my window," he said. Jean Howard, who has lived in the area for 6 years, said, "It was quite unsettling last night. You don't expect something like that between neighbours." Detective Chief Inspector Kev Barber from the Norfolk and Suffolk Major Investigation Team is leading the inquiry. He said, "This was a horrific incident for all those involved, including witnesses and first responders. Our thoughts remain with the family of the man who died. While we are still in the early stages of our investigation, we can confirm both victim and suspect were known to one another and were neighbours. The focus of our inquiries will be to understand the circumstances leading up to the incident. With Walcock being a small village, I appreciate this incident is likely to cause public concern, but based on what we know so far, we don't believe there is any wider threat to the public. I would urge anyone with information about this incident or anything they think could assist our investigation to contact police. Extra officers have also been posted in the area for reassurance. Anyone with information should call 101, quoting reference 305 of December 7th, 2025.
East Anglia's Children Hospices, EACH, is on the lookout for extra help to support its fast-growing retail operation. The charity, which assists children and families, seeks dedicated eBay champions to aid in retail shops across Cambridgeshire, Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk. In particular, the team are keen to hear from people interested in helping in Beccles, Bungay, Dereham, Halstead, Holt, Southwold and Wroxham, as well as Milton Road, Cambridge. Our dedicated eBay champions play a unique role, cherry-picking and spotting the potential of particular items, maximising sales and raising key funds to support our vital work, said EACH e-commerce manager Scott Campbell. We're looking for people with an eye for the unusual and an interest in photography who can use their IT skills to add donated items to our fast-growing eBay account. It's fun, exciting and rewarding, and selling goods online has become a big and fast-growing income stream for EACH. We always welcome dedicated eBay volunteers in any of our 54 shops, although we have particular and urgent need in certain areas. Anyone that can spare some time and lend a hand will be assured of a warm and friendly welcome. The charity welcomes potential volunteers to visit their shops. Call 01223 800 800 option 4 or visit the EACH website for more details. Nearly 800 children, young people and family members are currently receiving care and support. EACH says generally it is supporting more than 500 families at any one time, including bereaved. It needs to raise about £8 million from donations to keep running and is supported by more than 2,000 volunteers.
Proposed government changes to shotgun licensing have been branded yet another attack on Norfolk's rural way of life. George Freeman, Mid-Norfolk MP, has written to Home Secretary Shabama Mahmood ahead of a forthcoming consultation on plans to merge shotgun and firearms licensing. The Conservative MP says merging shotgun licensing with the tighter controls imposed on rifles and other firearms could impose unnecessary burdens on responsible certificate holders. And he said, "That will undermine the economic and cultural fabric of a rural community like Norfolk," where the MP said shooting has a significant role. The British Association for Shooting and Conservation, BASC, and Country Land and Business Association, CLA, have raised their own concerns over elements of the government's consultation. Mr. Freeman, a long-standing member of BASC, said, "As a shotgun certificate holder myself, I fully share the concerns being raised. Anyone familiar with Norfolk will understand how integral shooting sports and the wider shooting community are to our rural way of life. Game shooting plays an important role in the countryside, supporting habitat management and wildlife conservation, generating much-needed revenue for low-income rural economies, providing affordable and healthy local meat, and sustaining vital outdoor recreation and rural community life." Mr. Freeman said the government's proposals could impose unnecessary bureaucracy, delays and increase costs for those taking part in competitive shooting or clay pigeon shooting. He said the previous Conservative government had already consulted on changes after the aftermath of the Traffic Plymouth shooting in 2021, when Jake Davidson shot and killed five people, and decided not to move shotguns into the stricter licensing regime due to the impact on rural communities. Mr. Freeman said, "Of course we must make sure society is protected from the illegal use of firearms, but I believe any changes to the licensing regime should be evidence-based and not driven by ideology. Whether intended or not, this feels like yet another attack on our rural way of life." A Home Office spokeswoman said, "Protecting the public is our priority. It is right that we keep legislation on firearms under constant review and make changes whenever necessary. We have committed to launching a new consultation on the controls on shotguns. This is not about making life harder for those in rural communities. We will consider the evidence and whether necessary changes are required on the grounds of public safety after that consultation has taken place. No date has yet been set for the start of the consultation."
Plans for a major expansion of a housing and care development in a rural Norfolk town have been approved. Ash Tree Care Village in Reefham has been given permission to build 36 new homes on the Station Road site, which will add to the existing 15 assisted living bungalows developed in 2022. The expansion to the luxury development will see 22 more assisted living bungalows added and 14 more homes available for independent use. The applicant, Reefham Care Village Limited, said the project will provide an excellent form of care and be an asset for the community. The 2.75 hectare development will include 12 affordable homes, open space, and contributions toward local recreational facilities. Tim Gregory, a resident of one of the existing properties, said, "The homes are a brilliant concept." He added, "Old people have to live somewhere, and this seems to be a place where I can spend the rest of my life in lots of pleasure, good neighbours, and I couldn't wish for better." Broadland councillors approved the bid unanimously.
A festive procession of illuminated tractors will trundle around North Walsham as a popular Christmas fundraising spectacle returns for its third year. North Walsham Young Farmers Club annual Christmas light tractor run will take place on December 13. Last year's event featured more than 100 tractors and raised over £5,500 for the East Anglian Air Ambulance. This year, it will raise money for the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital Neonatal Unit, an intensive care unit which cares for babies needing medical help immediately after birth. Starting at 6 p.m, the route heads south from North Walsham for a tour of back roads and villages before returning through the town centre and marketplace. The club suggests good places for spectators include Green Road at about 6:10 p.m, Worstead Village at 6:40 p.m, Weaver's Way Car Park, Yarmouth Road at 6:55 p.m, North Walsham Marketplace at 7 p.m, and North Walsham Community Centre at 7:15. For more details or to sign up, visit North Walsham YFC on Facebook or Instagram, or contact North Walsham Young Farmers at gmail.com.
People in Sheringham have described how scary it was when bailiffs arrived at 4 a.m. as their battle to save a beloved bus shelter continued this week. Protesters have been demonstrating and occupying the bus shelter by North Norfolk Railway day and night since December the 1st, after it emerged workers had arrived to start demolishing it. Bailiffs arrived at 4 a.m. on Monday in an effort to clamp down on the protest and remove them. However, Norfolk County Council called off the bailiffs a few hours later, to the delight of the Save the Bus Shelter campaigners. Mark Campling, 50, reached the shelter just after the bailiffs arrived and said, "It was absolutely horrible. They wouldn't let us in. They blocked the door. My partner managed to get inside, but I couldn't get in. It was the worst 2 hours of my life, with them being so threatening." Protesters said four people were sleeping in the shelter when bailiffs arrived, and two guards stood at the entrance to the shelter to stop further protesters coming in. Mr. Campling said, "We didn't know whether they were going to forcibly remove us. We want to keep this a completely peaceful protest. We have received nothing but bullying tactics." Chris Perman, 33, was one of the four protesters inside the shelter at 4 a.m. when the bailiffs arrived to issue the same eviction notice the protesters had received on Friday. He said, "I was fast asleep and then I felt a kick to my feet. The bailiff said, 'Time to wake up and time to leave,' and I lost my rag a bit. Three others were still awake. We were concerned that they wanted us out to demolish it straight away. They were just very keen to get us out. I think they were willing to do whatever it took to get us out. 4 o'clock on a Monday morning was a really stupid." Liz Withington, 62, North Norfolk District Councillor for Sheringham North, has been a firm supporter of the protest and got to the shelter 10 minutes after the bailiffs arrived. She said, "The guards were quite intimidating. They would not let us in. It was quite scary. I relayed our solicitor's advice and that we would not be moving. Then we had this passive-aggressive standoff until past 8 o'clock. In a narrow vote at an emergency meeting on Tuesday night, Sheringham's councillors agreed to no longer support bulldozing the bus stop following 9 days of protests that led to standoffs with bailiffs. A huge eruption of applause and cheers erupted following the vote, with six members choosing to save the shelter. The decision could have huge ramifications for the council, which was warned by Norfolk County Council it may have to cover part of the £500,000 bill for the Transport Hub scheme if it did not go ahead. In a letter sent before the meeting began, County Hall officials warned workers will down tools and swathes of land will be left as a construction site if workers cannot demolish the shelter. The meeting had heard impassioned arguments for and against saving the bus shelter. Peter Ratcliffe, the previous mayor, said he wanted to see the scheme go ahead and insisted it would benefit bus users. Sue Brisbane added, "I understand some people are unhappy, and I regret that, but why did they not say anything months ago? I do not appreciate being pressured into decisions or having my integrity questioned by people who do not understand the process." She said she believes the revamp will help improve the town. But Liz Withington, a Sheringham District Councillor, said there were only 4 to 6 bus shelters of its kind left in the UK. "It is important from a national perspective that we preserve buildings of this era," she said. Before the meeting began, the council U-turned by abandoning its initial plans to hold some of the session behind closed doors. Following the vote, a spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, "We are disappointed we are no longer able to deliver this scheme. Our ambition has always been to deliver a high-quality, safe and accessible bus interchange that can accommodate the significant growth in passenger numbers we have achieved with our bus operators. However, We fully acknowledge the difficult decision Sheringham Town Council has had to make in the face of intense media and local scrutiny. We will respect that decision and will now stop all work and withdraw from the site as soon as possible. A key element of the proposed scheme was to widen the footpath outside the existing bus shelter, which is currently one of the main pinch points in the area. Without the ability to create this essential additional space, the scheme cannot go ahead as planned. The wider footway was necessary to reduce congestion between waiting bus passengers and pedestrians moving along this busy section of pavement. Because this pedestrian safety concern will now remain, we will need to review future arrangements for bus services at this location in order to solve the issue.
Our next few news stories include bus shelter row, Shepherd Hutt's court case, North Walsham new homes, solar farm axed, postbox cover-up.
The bus shelter standoff in Sheringham has sparked an extraordinary war of words between the MP who represents the town and the leader of Norfolk County Council. Kay Mason Billig, County Hall's Conservative leader, claimed North Norfolk MP Stefan Acquaroni, who has been supporting protesters trying to stop plans to knock down the shelter, privately told her the council should pause the project for a while, then continue with the demolition. But Liberal Democrat Mr. Acquaroni said Mrs. Mason Billig's comments, which she made in a Norfolk County Council meeting, were outright lies. NCC wants to knock down the 1950s bus shelter in Station Approach to replace it with a new travel hub at a cost of £580,000. But protesters occupied the bus shelter, which is on land owned by Sheringham Town Council, on Monday last week, as demolition was due to begin. They argue they have not been properly consulted and that the shelter should be retained. Mrs. Mason Billig insisted there had been consultation over the scheme with the majority of people in favour of the changes, which she said were needed to make it safer for bus passengers. She said the MP was on board, but now he sees the opportunity to grandstand and get his face on the front page of the papers. Even though I spoke to him last week and he said to me, "What you really need to do is pull this for about a week, talk to the people making the fuss, and then do it anyway." I thought that was a really disingenuous thing to say. He won't say that publicly, but that's what he said to me. I said, "We are not going to do that, Steph, because we have consulted on this." But a furious Mr. Acquaroni hit back, saying he had never made such a comment. He said, "These false and untrue accusations from the leader of the council are outright lies and further underline just how desperately badly wrong the Conservative-run County Council has got this. The people who I've stood shoulder to shoulder with night after night, who are still sleeping on beds of cardboard in the shelter in freezing temperatures, know exactly where I stand on this, and I won't back down until Norfolk County Council properly engages with residents, hears their views and moves forward constructively." Mr. Acquaroni said he had been in correspondence with Mrs. Mason Billig, in which he had sought a stay of execution to allow a return to the table to explore a design that can retain the existing structure. He said that during the exchange, Mrs. Mason Billig had said, even if the protesters had got involved sooner, the outcome would still be the same. Mr. Acquaroni said, "I reaffirmed my views to Kay on this, and her response confirmed to me that the consultation was a sham, and that whether or not the bus shelter being demolished was opposed by residents, Norfolk County Council would have gone ahead and done it anyway. That isn't just poor leadership, it's a slap in the face of the local community who still believe in democracy." The council had brought in bailiffs as it issued eviction notices to the protesters occupying the shelter, but stood them down ahead of last night's meeting of Sheringham Town Council. Mrs. Mason Billig said, "If the town council, which is the landowner, don't want this to happen, then maybe the whole bus improvement scheme has to be pulled and the money can be spent elsewhere." But she said that could mean buses would no longer use the shelter due to concerns about safety. The councillor said it needs to spend the government-awarded money for the scheme by March, or it could lose the money for it.
A campsite owner has signalled he will fight attempts to remove shepherd huts from his site after officials ruled they could not stay there. Nigel Marsh, who operates the My Mini Break campsite at Dam Hill Plantation in Edgefield near Holt, has faced enforcement action by North Norfolk District Council over the structures since 2023. He appealed to the Planning Inspectorate to fight having to remove the huts, but officials ruled against him. The council also ordered Mr. Marsh must cease using the campsite altogether, which the inspector upheld. But the businessman insists he has the correct permission to keep operating the site under permitted development rights, which would make this aspect of the ruling void. However, Mr. Marsh is still at risk of having to remove three shepherd huts after the official ruled they were permanent structures. In a decision notice, the official said, "My findings on the shepherd huts exclude them from the definition of a caravan due to them being mounted on a permanent base." The inspector said that the degree of permanence means they would constitute buildings. It has left the campsite owner flummoxed, as he says, "Shepherd huts are legally defined as a type of caravan, for which he believes he would have the correct permission." He said, "I made sure the shepherd huts met the criteria of a touring caravan. While I have taken the wheels off, they can easily be put back on and moved. How can they be considered a permanent structure? It's like arguing a car is an orange. These are individuals we look to keep our society running, but if these people are coming to stupid conclusions, then there is no hope for us." Mr. Marsh, who is no stranger to challenging councils, has said he intends to continue fighting the enforcement order and will appeal to the High Court for it to be overturned. He has also been involved in planning disputes with Fenland District Council and West Norfolk Council previously.
A Sheringham widower has slammed a council after his wife's gravestone was deemed unstable. Jim Lingwood, 68, discovered from a third party that a note was placed on the stone at the town cemetery by Sheringham Town Council. He was told that the headstone needed a ground anchor and was scheduled to be laid down flat in January following a safety inspection. Mr. Linwood described it as a box-ticking exercise, saying, "They're looking at this without common sense and not treating families with the respect they deserve. How is it going to hurt anyone? My wife's grave has sat there for 31 years and there has never been an issue. They say it's in danger of falling over. But if there's water in the carvings and it freezes, it's going to start breaking up, and that's much more likely to happen." Mr. Lingwood, who has lived in Sheringham for 47 years, said there had been no communication from the council and that they even spelt his wife's name wrong on the note. He added, "I don't even know who to contact. I'm a bit disappointed that there was no general ask around. Because they've tested it and deemed it unsafe, the course of action is to either lay it down flat on top of the grave, which is a trip hazard, or employ a stonemason to do whatever's necessary. I fail to see how they can justify this. I went up there myself and it's not wobbly at all. In fact, I'm perfectly happy to stand on it without any risk of being seriously hurt." The council response. A spokesman for Sheringham Town Council said it was legally required to carry out memorial safety checks every 5 years. The council added, "These inspections are part of national best practice and are essential to ensure the safety of visitors and our grounds team, as unstable memorials can pose a serious risk of injury." Sadly, there have been recent incidents nationally where memorials have fallen and caused serious harm, which highlights why these checks are so important. Our immediate priority is to maintain the safe environment for visitors and staff, so temporary measures have been taken to secure memorials that failed the checks. In some cases, this includes laying the memorial flat. Where contact details for grave owners are available, we reach out directly. However, this can be challenging as records are often outdated or incomplete. When no details are found, we use the electoral register as a last resort. If we still cannot make contact, we rely on public notices and signage. As a list of failed memorials was displayed at the cemetery and published online and individual notices were placed at affected graves, we understand this can be upsetting for families and aim to handle these matters sensitively while prioritising public safety. Where families would like to discuss options for reinstating an unsafe memorial to the required standard, we encourage them to contact the Town Council office. The council also apologised for the incorrect spelling, saying it was a human error and that it was reviewing processes to minimise the risk of it happening again.
Nearly £2 million is to be spent building 9 new homes in a Norfolk town, with construction due to start next year. Norfolk County Council's Conservative-controlled council has agreed to make £1.8 million available for 6 apartments and 3 bungalows in North Walsham. The money will be used for a scheme to provide the self-contained homes for people who need extra support to live independently. The homes planned for Yarmouth Road will be for people with learning disabilities, autism and physical disabilities, specially designed to meet their needs. A registered care provider will give support to the people living there. The Council's Cabinet agreed to provide £1.8 million to not-for-profit social housing provider Golden Lane Housing to develop the homes. The County Council would have nomination rights, so adults with social care needs could be housed in the new homes. County Council officials say that when the North Walsham scheme is complete and fully occupied, it will save the council at least £240,000 a year. North Norfolk District Council last month granted planning permission for the development on land which used to be home to Westover Vets before it moved in 2020. Alison Thomas, the County Council's Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care, said, "We have a huge success story here in terms of our supported living capital programme. We have a number of projects already on site being constructed at the moment, and here we now have North Walsham. Golden Lane Housing are being an incredibly strong and helpful partner in helping us to deliver bespoke support and independent living for people with learning disabilities and/or physical disabilities and autism. The council has been trying to address a shortfall in provision of supported living housing in Norfolk. A study in 2021 showed there was a need for 181 homes, and the council launched an £18 million programme to help get more built. So far, 31 new homes have been built, and 100 more are in planning, pre-planning, or are under construction. Swaffham, Norwich and King's Lynn are among the locations where similar schemes have been agreed. Work on the homes is due to begin in early 2026 and completion is expected by spring 2027.
Plans to build a solar farm in the Norfolk countryside have been rejected, as it would have left prime farmland covered in panels. Broadland District Council blocked proposals for the 230-acre installation on land off Aylsham Road in Causton, between Reefham and Aylsham. Its planning committee voted not to approve the scheme after a split vote. Joe Coppleston, a Conservative councillor, said she had grave concerns about the scheme, particularly over the loss of high-quality farmland she described as prime. More than 95% of the 93-hectare site is classified as prime agricultural land, which she described as Broadland's best and most versatile. She said, "I am worried about solar and protecting our food security. This is definitely our best and most versatile land." The council's decision to block the project comes at a time of growing debate about the spread of solar farms across the county. Supporters say they are vital to help the UK meet net zero targets, but opponents have raised concerns about the impact on agricultural land, food security, and the cost and efficiency of the installations. While Broadland Council is able to block this project, decisions over the fate of larger solar farms has been taken out of the hands of local councils and will be made by Ed Miliband, Secretary for Energy and Climate Change. The Causton scheme was put forward by renewable energy company Exergen Development Limited. It claimed the array would have been able to supply energy to 13,900 homes. Prior to the vote, Eleanor Lamming, Green Party councillor and vice chairman of the committee, spoke in support of the scheme. "We need to decarbonise the country and we are well behind government targets at the moment," she said. "We are already starting to see the impact of climate change in this county and across the whole world." While she acknowledged there would be temporary disruption to residents, she said she would be very happy to approve the scheme. Stuart Richardson, a Causton local who has lived opposite the proposed site for 26 years, said the village had endured significant increases in traffic and vibrations as energy projects were rolled out across the area. He warned that the estimated 104 daily vehicle movements involved in the construction process represents an incredible amount of traffic, and that the background hum from the battery energy storage system also posed a risk. Questions were also raised about how the farm would connect to the Saul electricity substation, which is located around 2 miles away. Plans initially put forward during the consultation period had suggested digging up the village's high street to install a connecting power cable, although this element was later withdrawn. Becca Leek, the agent speaking on behalf of Exergen, said that the cable route was yet to be confirmed. David Thomas, who covered the ward, said that without an agreed route, the scheme could not be considered deliverable and that it was highly unlikely they would choose anything but the cheapest and most direct route. "It's in the wrong place, close to too many properties, and it hasn't got a plug," he said.
People walking up the road to send their Christmas cards this festive season are being met with a rather Grinch-like surprise. Royal Mail is covering up its classic red postboxes with black bags this December. But the wrapping is far from cheerful and has left locals scratching their heads as to why the postboxes have been put out of action. Some currently feature a sign with a QR code explaining why it has been covered up, while others are simply wrapped up in plastic without explanation. The black bags come ahead of a new update to the design that will allow customers to send and return parcels up to the size of a shoebox. A solar-powered barcode scanner will open a drop-down drawer to place parcels that would not fit through the traditional slot. The slot will remain in place. It marks the biggest change to postboxes in 175 years. But the rollout has come at a time of year when many people need to use their local postbox more than any other. Royal Mail has described the upgrade as the postbox of the future. A spokesman for the company previously said, "Our new postboxes of the future offer another convenient way for customers in Norfolk, Lowestoft and elsewhere to access Royal Mail's services, alongside home delivery and collection. Our customer service points, post office branches, lockers and Royal Mail shop outlets. It remains unclear when the rollout will be completed and whether the affected postboxes across the county will be back in action before Christmas or not."
Some second homeowners have taken a Norfolk council to tribunal over paying double council tax. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, has received 6 formal complaints since the second home policy was introduced in April, with some citing frustrations over its exemption policies. Before the launch of the new premium, a flurry of coastal homes were put on the market in places such as Wells next to the sea, perhaps in an effort to avoid the new fees. Under the rules, property owners do not have to pay the higher rate for a 12-month period while homes are up for sale. However, NNDC says this exemption period begins when the home is first marketed for sale, not from when the new charges were introduced last year. The policy sparked a row with the second homeowners, who have complained it should have started when the new fees came into force. It led to a valuation tribunal, the first of its kind faced by councils in England, which ruled in favour of NNDC. It means people who put up their properties for sale before the changes came in will have to start paying council tax sooner after the 12-month period ends. Second homeowners must also prove they are actively attempting to sell the home and that it is not just a tactic being deployed to avoid paying the rate. The local government ombudsman was called in to rule on a separate complaint from the second homeowners about not being given enough advance warning of the changes. A man who lives outside the area argued NNDC failed to give enough advance warning about the changes and called for the fees to be waived for 2025. But the ombudsman was quick to dismiss the complaint and found, after an initial investigation, that there was insufficient evidence of wrongdoing. NNDC said it had advertised the changes in the press and had issued statements on its website, adding that it was also a much publicised national issue. Cabinet members voted for the 100% premium to continue into next year at a meeting this week, which will affect about 3,700 second homes.
A fourth generation family business is closing down after more than a century of trading. East Coast Motor Company in Cromer will close later this month after rising costs became impossible to overcome. The garage has been in the town for 105 years, first opening in Church Street in 1919, before moving to its current site on Beach Road. The business has struggled in recent years and stopped selling cars last year after its sales halved following the pandemic. It continued to operate as a workshop for servicing, MOTs and repairs, but will now close for good on December the 19th. Owner and Managing Director Adam Rounce, the great-grandson of the company's founder, said the decision was made with deep sadness and was not one I ever imagined having to make. The difficult economic climate and the cumulative pressures of recent years, rising costs and overheads, have created challenges that are impossible for us to overcome, he said in a Facebook post announcing the closure. To date, we are unsure of what will happen to the premises, but with the current economic climate, I do not foresee it remaining as a viable commercial site. The family firm, formerly known as Cromer Motors, started out selling brands like Austin, Morris, BMC, MG and Rover, building a loyal customer base over the years. In 1967, Mr. Rance's father, George, opened a Ford garage on Beach Road, where the company is based today. In 2021, Ford took the new car sales franchise away from all the smaller retail dealers across the country, but we continued to sell used cars and act as an authorised repairer for 3 years, said Mr. Rounce, who took over the business following his father's retirement. After that, we became totally independent. I'm truly grateful to everyone who has supported us over the years. To our customers, suppliers, friends and the local community, thank you. Thank you for being part of our history. You're listening to edition number 1997 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 12th of December 2025. Still to come, there are items about offshore workers, a beloved school head, and a win for villagers. And, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that,
this week's obituaries. Richard Harris died peacefully in his sleep on Sunday, November the 30th, 2025, after a short illness, aged 92. A wonderful husband to Pamela, whom we sadly lost in 2021, and loving father to Christopher and Nicola, granddad to Matthew, Dominique, Katie and Chantelle, great-granddad to Sophia, Ollie, Benji and Jude. Richard will be much missed by the family and his many friends in Sheringham and beyond. A celebration of Richard's life will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Tuesday, December the 30th at 11 a.m. No flowers, please. Donations in memory of Richard for Sheringham Little Theatre may be left in the retiring collection at the crematorium or care of Blythe & Sons Funeral Services, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ.
And Aureen Kimberley passed away peacefully on November 25th, 2025, age 91. Dearly loved wife to Tom, deceased, and mother to Jenny, Graham and Alison. The funeral service will be held at Green Acres, Colney Park, Watton Road, Norwich, on Wednesday, December the 17th, 2025, at 1 p.m. Donations to the East Anglian Air Ambulance may be left at the service or by following the link www.dignityfunerals.co.uk. Family flowers only, please. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
And now some local events. From Tuesday the 16th, you can visit Trimmingham Church for their Christmas tree celebration from 10 a.m, the 16th of December to the 4th of January. Visit Trimmingham Church and admire the beautiful Christmas tree display and decorations whilst enjoying some peace and quiet. St John the Baptist, Church Street, Trimmingham, Norfolk. Also on Tuesday the 16th, the Medieval Babes are performing at Norwich Cathedral at 7 p.m. On Wednesday the 17th and Thursday the 18th, you can visit Santa's Grotto from 9 a.m. at the Downham Home and Garden Store, Downham Market. G4 Christmas at 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday the 17th and Friday the 19th, at a cost of £16.50 to £74.50, you can experience the sumptuous harmonies of the magnificent vocal harmony group G4 in an idyllic festive setting. That's at Norwich Cathedral. Contact Nathan at amicproductions.co.uk. On Thursday the 18th, the Mini Museum Club Christmas has early years activities at Lynn Museum. It starts at 10:30 a.m. and it's free. That's Lynn Museum, Market Street, King's Lynn. Contact lynn.museum@norfolk.gov.uk or phone 01553 775 001. Also on Thursday the 18th is the Noel Night Train at 6:30 p.m. It costs £26. Kick off the festive season and join us for an evening of Christmas spirit and special train journey. Bure Valley Railway, Norwich Road, Aylsham. Info at bvrw.co.uk. Telephone 01263 733 858. On Friday the 19th, there's an opportunity to relive the glory days of the Garry, pre-Christmas glam rock party set to light up Great Yarmouth. 7pm, £15. If you love a proper sing-along, a packed dance floor, and heading home with your hair messy, your voice hoarse, and a huge grin on your face, then mark Friday the 19th of December 2025 in your diary. It's at St George's Theatre, King Street, Great Yarmouth. Contact admin at stgeorgestheatre.com or telephone 01493 331 484.
We now turn to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear about The Poor Man's Friend, Thomas Paine, Ben Young's Norfolk Roots and Career, Memories of Norfolk Snow, one of our favourite birds and its decline.
The Poor Man's Friend, from KL Magazine, November 2025. A gleaming gold statue standing proudly in the centre of Thetford serves as a striking visual reminder that the vibrant market town was the birthplace of one of history's greatest thinkers and revolutionaries. This grand memorial pays homage to Thomas Paine, an 18th century writer who was hailed as the Poor Man's Friend, and used the prolific power of the pen to become the first champion of freedom. Always fiercely controversial, revered by the masses, but disliked to the point of hatred by others, Paine was a man far ahead of his time. His powerful influence spread from this corner of rural Norfolk to the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. Inspired by his humble origins in a corrupt world, he penned earth-shattering pamphlets and books such as Common Sense, Age of Reason and Rights of Man, and became one of the greatest political figures of his day. As his birth town and the place where he spent his formative years, Thetford was boldly embraced Paine as a famous son, with the larger-than-life-size statue displayed for all to admire outside the former hunting lodge of James I on King Street. An inscription on the plinth describes Paine as an Englishman by birth, French citizen by decree, American by adoption. He is shown in dramatic pose, with a gilded bronze figure holding a quill pen in his outstretched right hand, and in his left, a copy of his iconic work, Rights of Man. Thomas Paine's legacy draws people from around the world to Thetford, said Oliver Bone, curator of the town's ancient house museum. Visitors enjoy admiring his statue and learning more about his remarkable life. Thomas Paine was born 100 metres from the Ancient House Museum in 1737, the son of a Quaker and corset maker by trade and an Anglican mother. The young Thomas would have passed the building, which was then a private house, on his five-minute stroll from his home to the grammar school. Paine's cottage stood close to the place of execution, where prisoners were tried and harshly punished. In the year he was born, William Wright, John Painter and James Blade were sentenced to death for stealing money, a bushel of wheat and a parcel of tea. In later life, an outraged Paine would speak out against the death penalty and was imprisoned in France for opposing the execution of King Louis XVI. Paine worked for his father for a time, but inspired by his schoolteacher William Knowles and books such as Robinson Crusoe, he developed greater ambitions. He left Thetford at the age of 19 and boarded the King of Prussia, a privately owned warship, in search of adventure. A classic late starter, Paine became a walking revolution. He stirred up the spirit of independence in America, defended the ideals of the French Revolution, and shaped democracy and human rights in Britain, where few people had the right to vote. In America, copies of his 1776 publication Common Sense sold like hotcakes and helped people decide on independence, and his American crisis pamphlets kept spirits up during the fight for a United States. After moving to France, Paine published Rights of Man, 1791-1792, a controversial treatise supporting the French Revolution. He was involved in the trial of Louis XVI, but fell out of favour with the revolutionary government and narrowly missed execution himself. Back in his homeland, the authorities organised a backlash against him and effigies were publicly burned up and down the country. On the 19th of January, 1793, the Bury and Norwich Post reported that an effigy of Paine was hung on a gibbet and burnt at Swaffham. Paine returned to America in 1802 and died there 7 years later. He was met with more hostility following his book Age of Reason, published in three parts between 1794 and 1807, which attacked Christianity and other formal religions. During the time he was writing this provocative work, a friend said of Paine, "His knowledge was universal. Among friends, his conversation had every fascination that anecdote, novelty, and truth could give it. Will you put on your spectacles, study his physiognomy, purchase his portrait, hang it over your chimney piece, and pointing to it say, 'This is no common man, this is the poor man's friend.'" Thomas Paine's inspiring words have influenced many over the years, with President Barack Obama quoting the remarkable writer as part of his inauguration speech. The infamous Napoleon claimed, "I always sleep with my Rights of Man under my pillow," and said of Paine, "A statue of gold should be erected to you in every city in the universe." Thetford's own statue of gold was commissioned in 1964, a gift from supporters in America. Although controversial at first, the grand structure and Thomas Paine himself are now a source of local pride. The town continues to celebrate its connections with Paine today, also housing the Thomas Paine Hotel and Thomas Paine Avenue. Would Paine be happy to be immortalised directly outside the King's Palace? Maybe not. But he would surely approve of the legacy he left and the glowing recognition he finally earned in his hometown. The Thomas Paine story is catalogued at the Ancient House Museum in White Hart Street, Thetford, which is open from Tuesday to Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
From Norfolk Magazine by Catherine Lana, rugby legend Ben Youngs on his career and Norfolk roots. He spent all his adult life in top flight rugby. In 19 seasons with Leicester Tigers, he's been a Premiership champion 5 times. He's played twice for the British and Irish Lions, and with 127 appearances for his country, he's the most capped England player. It's a phenomenal record, which has seen him travel the world, dine with film stars, and achieve some of the highest accolades the sport can offer. But when scrum half Ben Youngs announced his retirement from the game earlier this year, there was only one place he wanted to be. "I'm a Norfolk boy at heart," he says. "Though I've lived in Leicester for 19 years, it was never really home. I was there for the job and to pursue the ultimate dream. But I knew that when I was finished, we'd move back to Norfolk. Family's here." So he's been enjoying mudsliding and paddleboarding with his children in Blakeney, sharing family suppers in the farmhouse at Aylsham, and preparing for his new role as coach to his former school in Holt. It's clear he's relishing being back on the North Norfolk coast. "I didn't want to finish a game on the Saturday and start a new job on the Monday," he says. "I felt I had the right to have a break." But with the summer over, his early commitments will include his podcast, For the Love of Rugby with Dan Cole, and promoting his memoir, Beyond the Line, My Life in Rugby, which has just been published. Working on the book has been really rewarding, he says. For a lot of players, anyone who's done what I've done, you don't get the chance to reflect on what's happened and how you felt about it. The games come thick and fast, and you never really have time to process it. Working with writer Neil Squires, Ben addressed both the highs and lows of the professional game, the wins, the team building, the support of the fans, but also the tragedies he's experienced off the pitch, losing two family members to terminal illnesses within a year. People think it's all brilliant, he says. I did love parts of my rugby career, but I did hate other parts of it. Absolutely. He hopes the book gives an insight into professional sport, but also his particular struggles. His brother-in-law, Jake, died from motor neuron disease in 2022, and his sister-in-law, Tiffany, died from cancer in 2023. I've tried to be as honest as I can be and shed light on some of the personal stuff away from the game. I needed to share those parts of it because cancer in particular is something that's affected so many people. This was public and people knew how it ended. Life goes on and I was achieving all these things with everyone thinking you're having the best time in the world. But it just wasn't the case. It was difficult at times trying to separate trauma with a sport that you love and how they almost became merged as one, all those battles. I found it so incredibly hard to separate the two. I think I've benefited from reflecting on everything. And is sure that the time was right to step away from the game. The biggest worry for any player when they finish, though, is missing the camaraderie of the changing room, being part of a team, all looking out for each other. But I think moving back here, being surrounded by family members, I'll be fine. Both Ben's dad, Nick, and brother Tom played for Leicester and England, and growing up on the family farm, rugby was always encouraged. At Gresham School in Holt, both boys thrived at sport, and their talent led them first to move to the North Walsham team, and then to be spotted by the Leicester scouts. It's crazy that we've all done it, Ben said, of the family route into the game. Yes, we had talent, but I maintain that hard work has much to do with getting to the top level. I'm looking forward to sharing my experiences and helping them grow, he says of being Gresham School, new head of performance sport. Maybe they'll go on to great things in sport, and maybe they won't. But if I can teach them discipline, routine, and certain skills, hopefully they can take that into whatever they decide to do. I love the game. I'm really passionate about it, and it's given me so much, Ben says. But he knows there's more to life than rugby. I don't want to walk into a room for people to say, "That's Ben. He used to be a rugby player." It was a massive chapter of my life, but it's not going to be the part that defines me. Now I'm a husband, I'm a father, and I'm proud of coming from Norfolk. This is what I'm about, and this is what I'm doing now. This is who I am. Beyond the Line, My Life in Rugby by Ben Youngs is published by Macmillan.
Memories of Norfolk in the Snow, KL Magazine, December 2025. It begins with a chill in the air, a thickening of clouds and a whisper of frost across the fields, and suddenly we're wondering if snow might be on the way. Many now picture fleeting flurries that dust the landscape and vanish by morning. But for those who remember Britain's harshest winters, the season once meant something more. There was a time when snowstorms weren't just cold snaps, they were epic events. And with its vast skies and exposed coastline, Norfolk has weathered more than its fair share of legendary freezes. The winter of 1947 remains one of the most severe in living memory, with snow falling somewhere in the county for 55 consecutive days between January the 22nd and mid-March. In Norfolk, roads disappeared beneath towering drifts, railways froze, and the armed services were called to support isolated villages with supplies. Temperatures rarely rose above freezing, and coal deliveries stalled, leaving many families huddled around paraffin heaters in a desperate bid to stay warm. Lorna Kirk, then just 6 years old in South Creek, still recalls the awe of it all. "I remember travelling on the bus to Fakenham and being unable to see out the windows as there were piles of snow several feet high where they had been cleared from the road," she says. "My mum started making soda bread when supplies ran low, and we warmed bricks in the oven to place in our beds. It was so jolly cold." More snowy winters followed in the 1950s, captured in surviving photographs of blanketed streets, buried cars, and children sledging down the sloping parklands at Sandringham. However, it was the big freeze of 1962-3 that brought everyday life to a standstill. Snow began falling on Boxing Day and lingered for over 60 days, making it the coldest winter since 1740. Temperatures plunged to minus 15 degrees centigrade near Thetford, and some drifts reached 15 feet. The Broads iced over in places, and parts of the sea even frozen at Hunstanton. In Norwich, the River Wensum turned to ice, prompting excited children to hold football matches and skating championships on its crystallised surface. Drifts covered the roads, water pipes froze, and each morning we scraped frost from the inside of our windows. "It was like living in a snow globe," recalls Andrew Wright, who was growing up on a West Norfolk farm at the time. "I helped dig a pathway so my dad could get his tractor and trailer into town for food. Many farmers couldn't even reach their livestock, let alone harvest crops. It was really quite something." Another dramatic winter arrived in 1978-79, with blizzards battering East Anglia from the late December through February. Major roads were blocked, two-thirds of Norfolk schools closed, and power outages left hundreds of homes in darkness. In Narborough, Brenda Dent was snowed in with her four-month-old baby and remembers being stranded for around 4 days. "It just snowed and snowed. Drifts piled high and everywhere was covered in white. You could only tell cars were trapped by the aerials poking out," she recalls. "There were shortages of bread, milk and fresh meat, but the community was amazing. Tradesmen tried their hardest to clear paths. Farmers used tractors to help with deliveries, and my elderly neighbour baked loaves to share around the estate. Everyone pulled together. It was a wartime of spirits in the 1970s. Though less brutal than earlier decades, snowstorms in the 1980s and 1990s still brought disruption, wonder and community spirit. Many locals hold joyful memories of sledging and building snowmen. As in the 20th century gave way to the 21st, UK winters began to soften. Snow still swept across Norfolk, but the deep freezes of earlier decades became less frequent. In January 2010, a prolonged cold snap blanketed roads, closed schools and cancelled buses. Heacham became a ribbon of stranded vehicles. King's Lynn residents trudged through knee-deep drifts to reach work, and supermarkets in towns like Downham Market and Hunstanton saw essentials fly from the shelves. The Beast from the East in March 2018 brought another brief blast of chaos, and an icy surge in 2021 transformed familiar scenes into wintry postcards. Snow became less perilous and more picturesque, with white churches welcoming parishioners, rooftops shimmering at sunrise, and wells next to the sea beach huts standing proud against a frozen shoreline. Children rushed out with sledges, Dogs bounded over powdery paths and social media lit up with snow-covered landmarks and misty Fenland skies. Today, Norfolk winters may not freeze the sea or bury streets beneath deep drifts, but they still hold the power to pause our routines and stir our memories. Snow has become a fleeting visitor, more spectacle than siege, but its arrival still brings a hush to the landscape and a spark of wonder to the season.
The Sad Decline of One of Our Favourite Birds, from KL Magazine, November 2025. It appears that there's a day of celebration for most things now, so it's no surprise that this spring saw the observance of the 10th annual World Sparrow Day on March the 20th. For one, I've always loved the humble house sparrow, but the day had little to celebrate because it developed out of a great many serious and worrying issues. It is now designated as a platform to raise awareness of all formerly common birds, particularly in urban areas. The house sparrow, with the help of humankind, has spread to nearly every corner of the world and was close to being one of the commonest bird species. A lot of wildlife conservation naturally concentrates on precious habitats or rare animals, and it could be argued that we shouldn't be worrying about something as ordinary as a sparrow. But the way the house sparrow population has plummeted over recent years is quite staggering. And it's difficult for younger people to appreciate just how many there once were in our towns and cities. Formerly, apart from feral pigeons, most city dwellers' only regular encounter with the natural world was seeing sparrows. In fact, they were so commonplace as to be disregarded. As their name implies, every house seemed to have a sparrow or more. At sunrise, they'd form a chorus line along the guttering and in unison twitter a loud, repetitive song outside bedroom windows, even on a Sunday. As a child, I recall watching squadrons of them dropping into the garden and dust bathing in the fine soil by the cabbage patch. They'd squabble and argue, chasing one another from the cabbages to the runner beans and then into the heart of the privet bush. Sparrows would hop among shoppers' feet in the high street in search of crumbs, or line up on park benches at lunchtime. Although the sparrow's favourite haunt seemed to be the school roof, they'd wait patiently for the scattered contents of a tuck box. At least 20 and often more would gather at the feast. It was always a hasty affair, as at least one boisterous child would run wildly towards the birds, sending them into the air in all directions, only to meet again on the safety of the roof. House sparrows were an everyday part of children's lives. If they were lucky, one would fly into the school hall and disrupt morning assembly. No pupil could resist chuckling at the caretaker flailing a broom around his head whilst trying to encourage it out of an open window. Even in the heart of London, sparrows thrived. Since the 1920s, a remarkable series of autumn bird counts have been carried out in Kensington Gardens, which clearly illustrates the extraordinary decline of the sparrow. Some 2,603 were counted in 1925, but numbers dropped to 885 in 1948, 544 in 1975, 81 in 1995, and only 8 in October 2000, and very few have been recorded since. Of course, there were still a great many horses in London back in 1925, all requiring large quantities of oats, and plenty of run-down housing provided excellent nest sites. Despite this, in recent times, 74% of the house sparrow population has simply disappeared. This rapid decline was noticed by many people. Questions were asked in Parliament, and the Independent newspaper offered £5,000 for the first scientific paper which could explain the disappearance of the house sparrow from our urban areas. Only three entries were submitted, and the prize still hasn't been awarded. Clearly, the answer to the demise of our sparrows still isn't obvious, and is probably a complex combination of reasons. However, one notable discovery is that parent birds aren't finding enough small invertebrates to feed their chicks during the first few days after hatching, perhaps as a result of us having fewer urban gardens. Its country cousin, the tree sparrow, has fared much worse. With its smart chocolate brown cap, the tree sparrow was once a regular sight along the hedgerows of arable farmland. It has all but disappeared from Norfolk now, its decline a result of changing farming practices. Although attitudes are improving, many farmers are now leaving weedy margins on their fields, providing supplementary seed in winter and installing nest boxes. A small but important increase in tree sparrow numbers has been observed during recent survey work. This spring, I've built a terrace of sparrow nest boxes on the north-facing wall of the house. They like to be out of direct sun. For if we can't find space in our homes and hearts for the poor old sparrow, what hope is there? We need to let our children grow up in a world full of sparrows once again, instead of asking what's that bird in the very rare event they actually see one. For more information on the work of the Norfolk Wildlife Trust, tips on how to help the local environment, and details of upcoming events, please visit the website at norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of each of these articles for their contributions. Our last few articles cover mayoral elections anger, homes approved, and finally, Granny of the Year.
The postponement of the mayoral elections in Norfolk and Suffolk has sparked anger and left a planned shake-up of local government in chaos, with critics calling it an attack on democracy. Mayoral candidates across the political spectrum are furious after it emerged Number 10 plans to push back the vote for 2 years until 2028. The government is arguing the move is necessary to allow more time for local government reorganisation, which will see the abolition of district and county councils and their replacement by unitary authorities. But Labour's claims have been dismissed as spurious by reform leaders who say it is a ploy to prevent its candidate from winning the vote while the party surges in the polls. Other candidates fear the decision will stifle the region's economy due to the uncertainty it has caused and delayed to receiving millions of pounds in funds. It is likely to mean decisions over major projects like the Western Link, upgrading the rail junction at Ely, and improvements to Norwich Airport will be further delayed. The delay, which also affects mayoral votes in Essex, Hampshire and Solent, Sussex and Brighton, follows a previous decision to delay this year's county council elections until May 2026. Those elections are still due to go ahead. Nick Taylor, chairman of Reform's Norwich branch, said, "Clearly there is only one reason why mayoral elections will be postponed. It is because all or most of them will be won by Reform UK." The idea we need more time for local government reorganisation is completely spurious. People need to wake up to the fact that democracy is being eroded and Labour is slowly taking away the democratic fabric of our country. Reform are currently surging in the polls, with some suggesting 37% of people in Norfolk would vote for them at the next general election. The party has won several recent by-elections across the county, including King's Lynn, Thetford, Hunstanton and Dereham. At the by-election in Dereham, neither Tories nor Labour stood a candidate. The shock announcement comes only 6 months before the vote was due to be held, and with interviews already underway to recruit staff for the new mayoral authority. David Bick, who won a recent county council by-election in Thetford and was announced as Reform's candidate for the vote only this week, believes the delay will ultimately boost his chances. He said, "The reaction to this government's latest manoeuvre, which is clearly for political reasons, will harden people's frustrations, and I expect Reform's support to grow from here." The delay means Norfolk and Suffolk will have to begin receiving the £1 billion the region is due to receive as part of its devolution deal and which is intended to be used for mayoral projects to boost the economy. The Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government announced that the two counties will get an additional £1 million between them in the coming months to help with the costs of establishing the new mayoral authorities, and will share a minimum of £3 million over the next 3 years. Announcing the delay, Steve Reid, the Community Secretary, said, "Devolution is strongest when it's built on strong foundations. Therefore, moving forward, we will ensure strong unitary structures are in place before areas take on mayoral devolution." Tim Passmore, Suffolk's Police and Crime Commissioner and Conservative mayoral candidate, said, "The decision would damage investment in the two counties." He said, "The postponement of mayor elections for 2 years has demonstrated once again that Norfolk and Suffolk has been taken for granted by the Westminster blob." Having been assured the mayoral elections are definitely taking place only a fortnight ago by the policing minister, we are now witnessing yet another U-turn, if not a complete handbrake turn. This relentless confusion from government is damaging inward investment, economic growth and the opportunities for our young people. Strong and decisive leadership is vital for our two counties and certainly not weakness and vacillation. Labour's mayoral candidate, Carly Harper, said, "I am personally really disappointed by the postponement, but I always thought it was an ambitious timeline, so in some ways I am not surprised. I am pleased that creating strong unitary authorities remains the priority. For me, the plan is the same. Campaigning for a fairer, more ambitious region that realises its potential and benefits all our communities. And I look forward to defeating the far right at the earliest opportunity." Kevin Keeble, the Liberal Democrat candidate, added, "With support growing for the Liberal Democrats and minority parties like Reform, it is no surprise people are questioning the government's timing. Voters deserve to know this wasn't about politics." Norwich businessman Marcus Pearcey, who is yet to confirm his intentions to run for mayor but has signalled he is considering standing for the role as an independent, said, "Any move to postpone the elections would be a dark day for democracy." Caroline Topping, the Green Party candidate, said, "They're running scared of the opinion polls. They've seen the rise in support for the Green Party and Reform, and they are afraid they will lose control."
A new housing development in Norfolk's Bottleneck Village has been given the go-ahead despite dozens of objections. Proposals for 25 homes on land east of Rectory Road in Coltishall have been approved by Broadland Council. They will be part of the larger Bure Gardens development. Planning officers said the site near the Bure Valley Railway line was in a sustainable location within close proximity to many local services and facilities. They also said the development would bring economic benefits both during the construction period and through the increase in future local spending. During the planning process, 55 members of the public sent in formal letters of objection, raising concerns over the amount of houses and the loss of arable land, as well as the impact on traffic and wildlife. Coldshaw Parish Council also objected, stating the number of houses was excessive and would result in crowding. They also warned that the development's allocation of affordable homes, 5 for rent and 3 for shared equity, would be at prices which are not helpful to local residents who need them. Coldshaw on the Norfolk Broads has one of the few bridges over the River Bure which funnels traffic into the village.
Lonely people in Sheringham are being invited to a Christmas Day dinner. The church is inviting people to join them for lunch to enjoy the festivities in company from 11 a.m. The meal will take place at St Andrew's Methodist Church in Sheringham. People can book in advance by calling Nikki on 07733 317034, John on 07492 866242, or Jane on 07961 060680.
This year's Granny of the Year feature showcased the remarkable spirit, kindness and resilience of so many extraordinary women. Each nominee brought her own story of devotion, humour and inspiration, making the editor's decision an especially difficult one. After much consideration, the title has been awarded to our winning granny, Susan Wright, whose warmth and dedication stood out among an exceptional field. As part of the honour, she will be treated to a celebratory afternoon tea to enjoy. Thanks to everyone who nominated their wonderful grannies into this year's feature. Susan was nominated by her grandson, Tom Wright, who said, "My grandma is like a second mother to me, thoughtful, kind-hearted and selfless. Every day after school, I walk down the road and see her and my granddad, and they always make me smile. She devotes so much of her time volunteering for a day group for people with MS. She coordinates a day centre which runs many different activities such as fish and chip days, music, crafts and more. Countless hours are spent in and out of the village hall organising all aspects of this day centre, from transport to ukulele bands. I would say she is not only the most hard-working and loving person I know, but also my role model, showing me what it means to be generous, strong and dedicated to wonderful causes."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was David Mitchell. Editing and producing this issue was Manny Gomez. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio! Cheerio.